This is a Times Online podcast.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers. Welcome to issue 35 asterisk of The Bugle, Independence Day special. As we said at the end of last week's issue, we do not recognise American Independence Day because we don't recognise that America is technically an independent country. It's basically a suburb of Cornwall, as far as I'm concerned.
It's still Britain. We're trying to think the best of you people.
Yeah, if it wasn't for us, America wouldn't even exist. There would just be one massive ocean between the Atlantic and the Pacific.
You're welcome. You're welcome for being discovered.
I like to think that we invented America rather than discovered it, John.
Well, we discovered it as well. His name was Christopher, that's an English name. Spanish never discovered anything, they were too busy napping.
So in this Independence Day special, we will be having a special restaurant section and my special Independence Day story. Strap in for that one. Also in this week's show, a few extra sections that were simply too good to go in the Bugles when they were recorded, but I've calmed down sufficiently to go in this one.
And what are you going to do this Independence Day, Andy, that you're ignoring?
Catch a few waves.
Oh, that started to be a surprise, Andy. I mean, is that a metaphor, or are you actually going to go surfing?
Well, no, I'm not a surfer. Waves are what we in South London call thieves.
Oh, right. That's fine. You're going to go on your crime-stopping spree.
Yeah, a bit of vigilante justice. I'll put my special suit on.
Got your name on it anywhere?
Yeah, right across the back. Zoltzman, massive letters. And the number 10.
So that technically, Andy, makes you Zoltzman, the first ever Jewish superhero after Batman.
First ever?
Yeah, Batman, obviously is Jewish.
Well, he was Batchman originally. Double N.
Well, technically, you got man on the end of your name. Every superhero is Jewish.
Yeah.
How about that? Spider-Man?
Yep. Moses?
Yep. Well, he wasn't really a superhero.
Well, how many superheroes have ever led the Jewish people out of Egypt? Just one. Moses.
Andy, here's some news from my world. Buglers may not be aware that I have a very small part in a movie called The Love Guru at the moment, which has just come out to...
Good plug, John. Good plug.
Well, you said it's come out to some reviews which seem to think it's worse than Armageddon. And that's not the Bruce Willis film, that's the concept of humanity's complete destruction. You know, apparently this movie is worse than our collective extinction. But no, Sean Clark, the president of the Spiritual Science Research Foundation, has said the filmmakers and anyone involved in the making of this film could be condemned to the second rung of hell for 1,000 years. Well, even those who watch the movie risk 100 years in the nether region of Bavokalova, something like that.
Isn't she ranked 33rd in women's tennis?
He said, what goes around comes around in an interview from India. And acknowledged that he hadn't seen the film, but he caught the trailer online, which didn't leave anything to the imagination. I hate it when trailers do that, Andy.
John, I can't wait to see it.
Well, that's right. But what I'm saying is, if you do go, you're risking 100 years in the nether region of Bavokalova.
To be honest, I've probably got already plenty more than that stacked up.
That's true. I've got my next 1,000 years accounted for now. The second rung of hell.
Well, it's good to have a full diary, isn't it? You know, you've always got that to fall back on.
Axis of Evil news now. And the Axis is looking more and more lonely, having now officially lost two of its three members. It's now just Iran sitting alone up in its treehouse with its No Girls Allowed sign flapping defiantly in the breeze. This follows the news this week that North Korea has handed over accounting of its nuclear work to Chinese officials, apparently fulfilling a key step in the denuclearization process. An even bigger surprise than the fact that they've done this is the fact that we seem to be willing to believe it. The word of one of the wackiest dictators alive passed through the trusty hands of China. It's a communist relay of information. This is a nation that was ordering its nuclear weapons trucks to basically do wheelies in mass parades of power before the media, putting neon lights on the bottom of them and cruising around in front of the world. I don't know what's changed, Andy. Maybe the ambassadors of both countries have been going on bonding weekends, completing trust exercises by falling backwards into each other's arms. We don't know. This trust may be real.
Yes, North Korea, World Cup quarter-finalists as recently as 1966, of course, have been dropped from the Axis of Evil. And it does open up a gap in the rotation, John. Who is going to step up to the plate and take over the vacant Axis of Evil franchise?
Well, I mean, Bobby Mugabe's definitely got one wonky eye on the problem.
You think maybe Uzbekistan might have a half an eye on it as well? Their leader, Islam Karimov, loves a bit of human rights abuse here and there. Italy is a possibility. We know how much Silvio Berlusconi likes to get his picture in the papers. Scotland, you never know. They're a nation that is easily roused to anger. And
what about the Wu-Tang Clan, Andy? It would do a lot for their bad boy image to have that cemented ultimate gangster street cred, isn't it? Being actually part of an axis of true evil.
Yeah.
If that indeed is what the axis of evil is, which of course it isn't. But well, if it was, that would be great for rappers.
Well, you're looking at a definite extra 10,000 album sales if you're in the axis of evil.
North Korea has now been removed from the list of states who sponsor terrorism. So it won't be receiving any more birthday and Valentine's Day cards from the terrorists it has been sponsoring. Dear Kim, thank you so much for sponsoring me again this year. I've used your donations to commit a number of atrocities on civilians. It's been such a busy year. Hope you like the enclosed photograph of me in a balaclava. Thank you for that as well, by the way. Maybe you can stick it to your fridge. Question mark, exclamation mark, exclamation mark, smiley face. I've also painted you a picture of the plane I hope to hijack next year, God willing. Happy birthday, death to the West, Abdul. Oh, they're going to miss those, Andy. I mean, maybe they can sponsor a polar bear at a zoo instead, but it's just not the same.
This is my special Independence Day story. Are you sitting comfortably? Then I'll begin. When I was a child, I used to live in a little village in the countryside on the border between England and Britain. Every year on American Independence Day, our village would celebrate the careful release of those 13 carefully nurtured little baby colonies into the wild, and it would do so with a traditional British village fete. At which everyone enjoyed traditional British village fete activities, like looking at tables full of things, guessing the number of things in another thing, and throwing things at other things, and watching grown men whack each other with things. No nation is quite as adept at finding things to do with things as Britain. The most notable of our Independence Day village fetes was the one of 1982, and it was notable because of the tragic death of our next-door neighbour, Ralph, who perished in the course of attempting to become the first man in the world to catapult himself to the moon. Ralph was a fascinating man. He was very determined. His favourite trick was to steal the specials board from outside the village pub, the King and Führer. Well, the village really had hedged its bets during the early days of the war, and no one had ever got round to changing the name. Ralph would then replace the specials board with another one, advertising nothing but battered rat for £4.95. He did this every day for 16 years, until the pub eventually gave in and started serving nothing but battered rat. It proved to be extremely popular, showing that you cannot necessarily rely on market research to tell you what people want to eat. Ralph was not always a positive man, however. I remember at my third birthday party, Ralph pulled me to one side and said, "Andy, one day you and everyone else here in this room today will be dead. Dead as you f***ing like." It just seemed gratuitously negative on an otherwise joyous occasion. But anyway, Ralph died on the village fete of 1982, demonstrating his new lunar catapult, with which he hoped to become the first inhabitant of the village to land on the moon since Neil Armstrong, who passed himself off as American in order to maximise advertising revenue. It had already proved to be an unusually exciting fete. It had transpired that the best homemade jam competition had been rigged by a Malaysian betting syndicate, who had bribed the reigning champion and 12-time winner, Mrs. Annabelle Lart, to enter a jar of potato and gravel chutney. She lost, narrowly, for the first time in more than 20 years. Mrs. Lart, the self-styled genius of jam, spent her ill-gotten payment on a hydroelectric project to irrigate the Western Sahara, which everyone else in the village thought was a bit gay. Controversy also raged at the tombola, where old Mrs. Bagshaw won the star prize, a caravan full of crisps, only for her urine to test positive for a cocktail of human growth hormone, nandrolone, and the blood-doping steroid EPO. Let me tell you, her saggy face never darkened our village again, and rightly so. Of course, she claimed they were innocent byproducts of her arthritis medicine, but there's always a convenient excuse, and you have to be tough on these cheating old bitches. Anyway, at 3 p.m, Ralph marched purposefully out of the village hall, where he'd been preparing himself mentally for his catapult trip to the moon by firing 6-inch porcelain dolls of himself onto a moon-shaped object. I think it was a plate. Yes, it was a plate. He hadn't hit one yet, but fortunately, he didn't give a flying. He was about to go to the real moon. Out came Ralph. He walked past the bookmaker's tent, which had just stopped taking bets on Billy Stanton as the village boy most likely to turn into a sex offender. This was after his dad, weird Jeff Stanton, had put a £5,000 bet on his son with a strange glint in his eye. Ralph walked past the vicar, who was dancing around on a podium like a rescued wolf, celebrating winning the most bigoted villager competition for the second year in a row. It had been a titanic contest. Then, whilst Ralph was strapping himself into the catapult and doing his hair, the local primary school children performed an advertisement for home insurance. They'd learnt to love reading and realised that in the modern world, they'd have to compromise their ideals if they wanted to have some books. So after the advertisement had cleverly instilled the fear of burglary in the minds of the audience, Ralph pulled his stained glass visor over his face and uttered a pagan incantation about pineapples. He thought it was one about safe moon landing, so in some ways it was appropriate. At this point, the local mayor, Sylvia Kopp, walked forward to perform the launch. She was not one of these newfangled elected mayors. In fact, the post had never even existed until she secretly appointed herself and started turning up to school speech days in official-looking regalia. People were a bit annoyed at first, but no one wanted to make a fuss. We were British, after all, besides which she was very enthusiastic and didn't really wield that much executive power, and she had a spangly, spangly hat, and that is how British democracy works. The tension grew like a fox. This was the defining moment for Ralph, all his week of preparation condensed into this one instant, the future stretched out before him like an attempted catapult trip to the moon. The mayor stepped forward and prepared to slit the throat of the ceremonial goat, whose collapsing corpse would release the catch on the cage of the pigeon, who'd been trained to fly into a set of scales which, once unbalanced, would tip a rock onto the head of the local MP, who would be reminded to remind Ralph to pull the lever and set his catapult in motion, thus beginning his journey into space. A huge cheer rose from the crowd. Not to encourage Ralph, but due to the fact that Mrs. Robbins, the school headmistress, had unexpectedly dropped her kecks and moons the crowd. It was only years later that she received full credit for her brilliant visual pun. The mayor's knife, after two very amusing dummy sacrifices, which really got the crowd on her side, now came slashing down across the neck of the goat, who, as he fell, seemed to mouth the words, "Why? Why me? When will the killing end?" Thus was Ralph hurled skywards. Away he flew, upwards and seemingly onwards, all the way to the moon. He flew over the bouncy castle where the terrorists were hiding, over the swings where a troupe of satirical mime artists were doing their impression of public opinion, over a cow, and seemingly onwards towards the moon, until Ralph crashed screaming into the overhead power cables. Now, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because Ralph had feared just such an eventuality, and he was wearing a wooden moon suit so he didn't conduct electricity. But unfortunately, just as it seemed that Ralph had escaped unharmed, the elastic effect of the power cables flung Ralph back across the village at some speed. Ralph flew back over the tax evasion tent where the village accountant was high-fiving himself to assuage his sense of social guilt, over the village shop which had been struggling ever since it stopped selling groceries and started specialising in rotating stages, until he landed stomach first on the point of the church steeple. Again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because the previous year the parish council had had the steeple blunted after misunderstanding a new European Union directive. The crowd cheered, but unfortunately, just as it seemed that Ralph had escaped unharmed, the church was blown up by a demolition team. Because the village had voted atheist in the local elections, much to the disappointment of God, who had somehow lost touch with the crucial floating voters, largely due to complacency. He'd done bugger all interesting for almost 2,000 years. It was time for a change. Ralph tumbled down amidst the collapsing masonry edifice, but amazingly, none of the falling building landed on Ralph, whether by divine providence, secular providence, or just plain luck. It's very hard to tell. Most of it, to everyone's delight, fell on the village library. No one likes a smart ass. But just as Ralph thought he'd escaped unhurt, the church bell, which had been designed by a cartoon animation company and which had been caught unawares by the demolition of the church, realised it was no longer supported by anything, looked downwards to the ground in terror, grimaced, and plummeted directly onto Ralph with an amusing clang. Now, again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because Ralph was a tough, God-fearing man who didn't bruise easily. The crowd howled with excitement. Ralph crawled out of the rubble, but unfortunately, just as it seemed that he'd escaped unharmed, an unexploded canister of poison gas from the unpublicised 1975 to 1978 war with Portugal blew up next to him. It had been quite a brutal war, but one that the media had never quite managed to get an angle on, so hadn't ever reported. But again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because Ralph had lived in a tiny cubbyhole underground for several years and had learned to get by without oxygen, which he'd always considered to be one of the most arrogant of all gases. Breathe me or you'll die. Wah, wah, wah. The crowd roared again. They were really getting into this now. Ralph staggered out into the open air. But unfortunately, just as it seemed that he had escaped unharmed, an aeroplane crash-landed on his head. But again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because it was a paper aeroplane thrown by the local dentist, trying to lose his reputation as a fun-hating fuddy-duddy. It wasn't that people didn't like him, they just wanted him to lighten up about the whole teeth issue. The crowd, now becoming a bit bored, did a Mexican wave, but unfortunately, just as it seemed that Ralph had escaped unharmed, at that very moment, his 30-year pact with the devil expired. The servants of Satan emerged from the King and Führer and escorted Ralph off to the underworld. And he began to think that maybe he hadn't made the most of his 30 years of satanic omnipotence. He'd spent much of it manacled to a rock, surrounded by fire, being flagellated and prodded with molten prongs. With hindsight, he thought, he could have waited to do this until his eternity in hell. Hindsight, schmindsight. Ralph was on a one-way ticket to hell. But again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because it transpired they didn't actually have the correct paperwork and Beelzebub is nothing if not a pen pusher, so they had to release Ralph on a hastily drafted 3-week extension clause. At which point Ralph died of a hereditary heart defect. But again, in itself, this would not have been fatal, because whilst at the Undertaker's, Ralph remembered that there was in fact no history of heart disease in his entire family. He'd just watched too many TV documentaries about cardiac problems, and he was easily persuaded. Realising his mistake, Ralph sat up with a jolt, banged his head on the lid of his coffin, knocked himself unconscious, and died a short hearse journey and a blessing later of 100% burns. We can learn a lot from the tragic story of Ralph. Well, it wasn't maybe that tragic because no one liked him and he didn't spend a lot of money in the village shop, so local businesses weren't too adversely affected, and that's how we should judge these things nowadays. If anything, his death boosted the local economy. But I digress. There are lessons that we can learn from the story of his Independence Day catapult adventure. We can learn, as Ralph did, that ignorance of our history can be ultimately fatal. We learn that even the devil is subject to tight regulatory controls these days, and a good thing too, otherwise who knows what the little f*** would get up to. We learn that dentists are different to the rest of humanity, but it doesn't do anyone any good to just marginalise them. We learn that some wars don't get the media coverage that they deserve, that God and democracy will never mix, that not all bureaucracy is as fun as your parents would have you believe, that we should make more of an effort with Europe, and we learn that power cables aren't always a sign of progress, and that catapults, although a bad means of transport, do reveal the absolute truth about everything. Happy Independence Day.
Tiny irrelevant island news now. And President Cristina Kirchner of Argentina mentioned this week that Argentina's claim to the Falkland Islands, currently, of course, in British hands after our little skirmish in 1982, is inalienable. The Vice President, Julio Cobos, went even further, saying, "We must recover this territory that is ours, which belongs to us." Hey, hey, hey. Back off, Argies. That tiny slab of rock is ours. You'll have to prize it from the Queen's cold, dead crown. We don't have much empire left, and the ones that we do have are not going anywhere. Do you hear that, Bermuda? Don't you even sneeze in the wrong direction.
In fact, the Falklands are really pretty much all we've got left, apart from Gibraltar and Wales. And besides, the Falklands were promised to us by God in the Bible. Israel for the Jews, the Falklands for the British.
That's true.
Argentina have claimed the islands ever since Britain scored them in 1833. America was credited with an assist after destroying an Argentinian settlement in 1831. That's great teamwork. That is the special relationship working as it should work. The islands, of course, are of crucial strategic importance if you're trying to do a sponsored walk across the Falkland Islands or wanting to win a war in the Falkland Islands.
This could be a huge opportunity for the royal family, though, Andy. There are a lot of royal family members, especially when you take in the extended family, who, of course, still receive taxpayers' money. We've all seen what fighting in Afghanistan did for Harry's popularity. How about having the royal family alone defending the Falkland Islands? Under Harry's command, we'll fly them all over, give them as much equipment as they need, and they will face down the entire Argentinian armed forces. If they win that, they'll be almost as popular as Diana was. Now, some would say, what is the point of the Falkland Islands? They are 5,000 miles away and are inhabited mainly by sheep and fishermen. Well, I'll tell you what the point of it is. It's becoming a massive tourist destination. Why? Well, it's one of the most exciting islands on the planet. After the disastrous and pointless war of 1982, approximately 25,000 landmines were left around the island. And you can get free maps of where the landmines are from the Explosive Ordnance Disposal Office in Stanley. And what a vacation map that is. Don't tell me where the local restaurants are. I want only concealed landmines on a map. Otherwise, I simply can't engage in a vacation anymore. It's the ultimate adrenaline rush for those who like extreme sports or office team-building exercises. Why not bring your entire office down to the Falklands and see how many of them make it back? You'll be a stronger and slightly smaller work unit.
But I think maybe the time has come, John, for Britain and Argentina to strike a deal. We let them have the Falklands, but they, in turn, have got to let us have the 1986 World Cup, which they cheatingly stole from us when Diego Maradona unfairly, cheatingly dribbled the ball past Beardsley, Reid, Fenwick, Butcher and Shilton before illegally kicking it past Stevens into the goal with the so-called foot of God. The Falklands, for that World Cup win, John, I think 99% of the English population would sign up for that.
The Bugle feature section. This week, restaurants, or as the French say, restaurants, as they should pronounce it, restaurants. We invented words. We'll tell them how they're supposed to sound. All right, we didn't invent that word, but we invented more. We got more words than them. The point stands. Bloody French. And Andy, my restaurant of the week is a fast food restaurant, which opened in the southern suburb of Beirut this week. Always difficult opening a restaurant, Andy. So important to stand out for the crowd. But I think this one has already done that. You need a catchy name and a unique concept, and I believe this establishment has come straight out of the blocks on this one. It's called Buns and Guns, and its decor is made to look like a military post. Diners eat to the sound of gunfire instead of Muzak. Say what you like, Andy. They have committed to the idea. Owner Yusuf Ibrahim presents rebranded Lebanese favourites like the, and again, I quote, rocket-propelled grenade, brackets, chicken on a skewer, and terrorist bread. He said, they accuse us of terrorism, so let's serve terrorist bread. Why not? Good question. Good question, Yusuf, and one that it seems you didn't ask yourself until after you'd completed the restaurant. There are certainly a few reasons why not. Taste, decency, and basic human respect. But, let's be honest, dining is a competitive field. You know, it's war, to use an unforgivably crass analogy.
I think what this story shows, John, is how important it is not to open up a restaurant when you're in the middle of feeling really angry against the West. That's the key.
It's like, don't go shopping when you're hungry, because you'll buy too much.
I think maybe you're misinterpreting this restaurant, John, as sort of glorifying terrorism. I think it actually could play a crucial role in weaning terrorists off violence, because terrorists can now take out their anger towards Israel and the West in the form of a tasty snack. Watch and learn, United Nations.
I mean, you say that, Andy, but their motto is, and again I quote, a sandwich that can kill you. Again, the owner says the only way they can kill customers is with their generous proportions. And he told a journalist this, who was, and yet again, I quote, chomping on an RPG sandwich. I think that's actually a military term, or a very imaginative euphemism.
Well, of course, a sandwich can kill you. Motto has been used before. In fact, it was used compulsorily on the demand of the health and safety inspectors at Uncle Luigi's all-you-can-eat for £1 Burgerorium on Scravington Seafront.
But if you are in the southern Beirut area, I recommend taking a first date there. Real icebreaker. Conversation starters around the restaurant.
It's reminiscent of the famous British Army restaurants in the early 20th century, which served trench fries, somm burgers, and boasted that its cheese was always over the top. In other restaurant news, a vegan restaurant in Montreal, Canada, has apologised to customers after serving the heads of endangered monkeys in a salad. Manager Alvin Light Brigade explained, "It was a mix-up with our suppliers. All I can say," he laughed, "is that somewhere there's an oil tycoon trying to shock and impress his friends with a load of aubergines." And a kebab van in Oxford has become the first vehicle of its type to be awarded a Michelin star. The mobile doner kebab and baked potato specialist Ahmed's was given the award after a Michelin judge chanced upon it upon the high street on his way home from a victorious quiz night at the nearby Wheat Sheaf pub. "I'll tell you, it really hit the spot," he said. "The chilli sauce was perfection in a squeezy bottle, and the garnish of chips on top was a culinary masterstroke. All in all, global fusion cuisine did its tummy-filling best. Ahmed never lets you down." Sport now. The annual World Wife Carrying Championship is scheduled to take place in Sonkajärvi, Finland. The course involves 250 metres of pure, unadulterated spouse lugging. The controversy reared its ugly head a couple of years ago when the winner, Renzo Helicopelli of Italy, was disqualified when it turned out that the wife he was carrying was, in fact, Joan Rivers. And although you don't need to actually use your own wife in the race, Regulation 21.4 of the International Wife Carrying Association laws states that you can't use Joan Rivers, Nancy Reagan or Bo Derek. In 2005, controversial basketball star Dennis Rodman entered but had to pull out due to, quote, health problems. Or was it simply, Rodman, that you can't pick anything up without trying to drop it through a hoop? My money this year is on one of the Usorg brothers from Estonia, who between them have won 7 of the last 8 titles, 5 of them for Margot Usorg, with a total of 3 different wives. Which proves, John, that carrying a woman 250 metres is a good way both to pull a new wife and also to make a current wife think very hard about the way your relationship has developed. I guess it's an evolutionary thing. Women clearly primevally like the idea of having a man who could carry them 250 metres away from danger quite fast whilst negotiating 3 obstacles, one of them aquatic.
Sure.
But then they equally primevally become sceptical about a man who actively chooses to do that for fun whilst being cheered on by a crowd of Finns. That's Darwinism in action. And Estonians, John, have won the last 10 titles in a row. Why are Estonians so good at carrying their wives? Is it fear of being eaten by a bear? Is it laziness on the part of Estonian women? Or is it simply lack of alternative forms of entertainment?
So that's it for the Bugle Independence Day special, which is not actually commemorating Independence Day because, as we all know, Independence Day does not exist. Like we've said, we're trying to think the best of you people. You could still be British if you wanted, and deep down you know you want it. Why else would there be so many British people doing late-night infomercials? If we can sell you a whisk that will make you a 30-second omelette, surely we can sell you on the concept of having the Queen back.
I hope all our American listeners are feeling suitably chastened, and all our otherworldly listeners. Is that the right term?
Otherworldly? Yeah, I mean, it definitely isn't. It's the wrong term. Otherworldly listeners. I didn't realise you were into aliens.
Well,
let's not rule it out. We're on Mars.
That's the great thing with the internet. We're on Particularly Mars. With wireless now. They can probably pick it up.
So we'll be back next week with Bugle 36, a proper bugle, parping through the airwaves to our otherworldly friends who, if they're ever to take over the world, then, yeah, Andy and I will be waiting as your loyal servants.
Do keep your emails and hotties flooding in to thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Bye!
Cheerio!
This is a Times Online podcast. For more podcasts, go to timesonline.co.uk/podcasts.